Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I'm your host, Dwayne Mancini. As always, if you need anything from the podcast or would like to suggest a future guest, please email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. And you can always visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, or follow us on LinkedIn. My guest today is Mina Fahim. Mina is the President and Chief Technology Officer at MetaView. In this episode of the podcast, Mina and I discuss MetaView, what it is, the mission they're trying to solve, and where they are, lessons he's learned along the way, and advice for startup companies. If you are a startup or thinking about starting a startup in the medical device space, there's no one better to learn from than someone who's going through the exact same thing that you will have to go through. And in this episode, Mina dives into great detail into the lessons he's learned and the advice he would give to startups if he can go do it again. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my discussion with Mina Fahim. Mina, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dwayne. It's awesome to be on with you.
Yeah, it's awesome to see you again. The last time we met was in January, and actually got to get a cup of coffee together. Obviously, social distance at the time, but it's good to see you again. So, Mina, why don't you give the listeners just a brief background on your history in the med tech space, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, no, thanks, Dwayne, for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure. So yeah, my background is in biomedical engineering. My deep interest in the human and business side led me to go back and do my MBA with a focus on innovation commercialization. Was in the class three med tech space for transcatheter heart valves. So right when the space was taken off, right, being able to perform a complete heart valve replacement without having to open the chest back in 2010 was 2008, 2009, space really started taking off. I absolutely loved it, worked for St. Jude Abbott, got to see a product all the way from concept to commercial, be at some of the first in human procedures and see people. And what's really interesting, Dwayne, is actually one of the designs that our team actually put together was just released by Abbott a couple of weeks ago. So 9.5 years later, you see it come to fruition. So that's why I love being part of MedTech, is there are instances, right, of instant gratification, but it's the process and journey to go from concept to commercial that's I absolutely love. And that's rewarding for me at a professional level, but also for the patients, obviously. So I got tapped on the shoulder actually by Medtronic and said, hey, why don't you come over and be an electrician rather than a plumber? And I went and joined the Medtronic's AF Solutions, Atrial Fibrillation Solutions group, where I was working on ablation therapies and navigation therapies for cardiac ablation. And really different skill set, went from a class three to a class two space disposables and got experience there. And really started kind of, I've always kind of been like an intrapreneur within the big motherships, which, you know, I loved working for Abbott. I loved working for Medtronic. And then really started an internal initiative at Medtronic around mixed reality and artificial intelligence. And that really started to take off to the point where people were like, hey, we've never seen an organic project like this take off before in such a short amount of time. And as you're very familiar with, I'm sure, the digital and data space for med tech over the past 5 years has really grown at an exponential rate, with some tremendous growth opportunity and different market factors driving that. So MediView came, I was actually, quick story, was actually judging the Cleveland Clinic Innovation Competition and was one of the judges and learned about MediView. And about 8 months later, got a call from them saying, hey, why don't you come over and help us lead the commercialization and technology development for mixed reality surgical navigation. And I always like to say this is, I didn't leave Medtronic, but I came to MediView. I loved working at Medtronic, got some tremendous wisdom from a mentor of mine that said, you should put all the possible roadblocks up not to leave Medtronic and see if they come down. And it took 4 months from the day I was contacted about the opportunity with MediView to the day I actually signed an offer was about a 3.5-4 month period, put up roadblocks. Over time, those roadblocks came down and I've been at MediView now since October of 2019, so almost 18 months. We just released our first commercially available product in the US. So I was employee number two, and now we've got 18 employees, which has been absolutely wonderful to see grow in the past 18 months. And we've just got an incredible team that has developed a sense of trust and is developing a track record, you know, from our backgrounds and histories coming into the company, various, you know, 8 different companies, 9 different companies coming together, but now developing a MediView track record around delivery of commercial capabilities within the mixed reality and AI space. So a little bit of background on me. It's been a wonderful journey thus far.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. So let's dive into the MediView piece. You guys are headquartered in Cleveland, Ohio. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, yep. Awesome. So yeah, let's talk about, you know, you're the chief technology officer. So no one knows the technology better than you here. Let's talk about what it is and what you're doing, what you're trying to solve, what's your market, all that kind of good stuff. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, my role has expanded since we last talked, actually, Dwayne. So I was asked by the board of directors to take on the role of president in the company.
Oh, wonderful.
So I now serve in the capacity of president and CTO. And really, the reason I want to provide that detail is because it probably reflected in my answer a little bit from both perspectives. MediView started as actually licensing of some really novel IP from the Cleveland Clinic. So our co-founders, John Black and Adam Rakestra, both longtime medical device professionals from the commercial side, saw this novel technology by co-inventors, Dr. Jeff Yanoff, PhD, and Mr. Carl West, who runs one of the research labs at Lerner Research
Institute. I know Carl.
Okay.
Yeah. 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 Yep.
So they saw the technology and where it was incubated. It was in a fairly raw form, but they saw a huge potential in it. And having started an organic development project at the world's biggest medical device company, I saw that MediView had solved a big technical challenge that would make a product for intra-procedural, right? The use of AR during actual therapeutic or diagnostic procedures is the next step, where AR mixed reality has started to be used heavily in education, in training, in task execution. But now you're talking about the use of this, you know, new user interface, the new age of computing, at the point of care during therapy delivery and diagnostic purposes. And so I saw the unique IP and I was skeptical, right? As an engineer, you're trained to be skeptical. And so when they presented, when I first got to meet MediView, I was like, I don't believe you guys. I don't believe that you've solved this problem, which is the problem is, imagine, Dwayne, reaching in, being able to literally reach into your computer screen, grab a CT or MRI that shows that's the patient anatomy, and then position it directly overlaid on the patient's body in the real world. Mm-hmm. And they had found a very elegant, very efficient way to do that. And John at the time said, you know, don't take my word for it. Sign this little NDA, come over, check it out for yourself. And when I saw it, I was like, okay, it's raw. It has a big delta to go from concept to product viability and commercial utility, but the core of a product is here. And that's really when my journey with MediView started, exploring it, assessing it. And MediView, since then, right, that system is what we're referring to as our acuity navigation system, where literally the clinician has X-ray vision into the patient, putting on a HoloLens, we the target device. We're not exclusive to Microsoft HoloLens by any means, but they've fundamentally built the best off-the-shelf mixed reality interface and the ecosystem around it. There are other really good devices out there, but to date, they've been the best option for us. And we've done 14 in-human evaluations with our technology. We just brought the first component, which we refer to as our minimally viable product, to market in April. So, you know, when people first saw a touch phone, they didn't know they wanted a touch phone because all they were used to was these flip phones. And one of the things that we wanted to do was give our customers the training wheels for this new user interface. So we recently released what's called MediScout. It is a flexible heads-up display of medical imaging, starting out with ultrasound and progressing to the interventional suite after that. That actually helps, I don't know if you know this, Dwayne, but in the US alone, medical sonographers struggle at 90% with musculoskeletal disorder that results in $120 billion of economic impact annually. And wow. I'm saying million, I'm saying billion.
Right, wow.
And so the clinicians and the nurses and the PAs are like, you are saving my neck, you are saving my back, being able to do this. So from a jobs to be done perspective, we realize, hey, there's real value in a minimally viable product here. So it gives them the opportunity to literally grab the medical imaging, bring it directly in their field of view at an ergonomic position, and it enables seamless remote collaboration at the point of care where they can make a call directly from their interface to, you know, Dwayne, who's watching on Microsoft Teams and is able to see through their eyes what is happening at the point of care to the patient and in the imaging. So that's our first product that then we will layer on additional capabilities to build out the platform to the full holographic surgical navigation system for percutaneous or minimally invasive procedures.
Wow. So first of all, just a little bit of history here too. You mentioned John Black is the CEO of MediView. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So I had met John in a previous job at a conference. We didn't do any work together, so it's not like we're disclosing breaking an NDA. Right. But we, I met John and got to try the technology, and it was actually my second time trying the technology. Right. So the first time was even before that at the Cleveland Clinic. I was just taking a tour of the Learner Institute, yeah, or whatever it is. And I was talking to Carl, and you know, he had said, hey, you look at this new technology we're working on. This is years ago, right? And then I saw John at this conference, and he was letting people try the technology, and I got to talk to John, and this is before you were with the company. And it was really neat. And so just the evolution of this technology, I mean, the core principle's been there, but just how it's changed and how it's evolved and how it's gotten better. It's actually a great example of an episode we just talked about where it was with Devin Campbell from Product. And he talks about voice of customer and how a product evolves and your minimally viable product and you, so your MVP. And you guys are actually living this out, right? As you take in the different voices of customer, your big ones being patients and end users, but also I'm sure you've made updates and changes from regulatory, reimbursement, marketing, your commercial plan, right? It's all said and done, MediView is probably an amazing case example of how you take this all in and build out your product and build out multiple products or your platform technology or whatever it may be. So just everyone to get a little bit of background here, I've kind of seen this play out, right? And now where you guys are being, like you said, 18 employees, you said, it's awesome to see, especially because, you know, so everyone knows I live in Cleveland, Ohio, so I'm always rooting for the home team.
Yes.
And you know, it's really cool. So you guys have a product that is cleared by the FDA or?
So it's really important, and this is right, protection disclosure, is we, our first product at a minimally viable level,
yeah,
product is a class 1 medical device, which is
got it,
is a FDA registration. So
right.
we still have to register as a medical device manufacturer, still comply to the ISO standards for development of a medical device. That because it is considered an accessory to standard of care imaging, plus a communication tool, that falls under what is the class one designation.
Okay.
Our upcoming devices, so those are called registered medical devices, and they're subject to audit or inspection by the FDA at any point. And really, we've built an amazing team. Actually, you hit on a couple of really important points, Dwayne. We've brought regulatory competency internally. We have an amazing internal regulatory manager who has a deep background in image-guided therapies. We have an excellent development and engineering team that's making these products come to life. We've brought actually human resources internally. And some people would say startup, you guys have an HR department. And Terry, our HR, our entire HR department, she wears a number of hats, has made our lives exponentially easier because she handles so many different biz ad parts of the company, different business administration parts of the company. So our first project or product, sorry, MediScout, is a class one registered device. And we are growing our product portfolio with upcoming 510K class two submissions, which will then result in clearances of medical devices to be used as aids of primary medical modes of decision making. So that's coming up in the next, I won't commit to a timeline on here, but coming up very in the relatively near future for the company.
Okay. Yeah. So I wasn't sure. So you said you're a 510K. Did you have the discussion, because your technology is disruptive, right? Did you have the discussion of 510K versus de novo internally? Was that something you talked about? How did you arrive at that 510K decision? And then I wrote down another question about something you brought up too. So we'll get to that. But I first want to touch on this 510K versus de novo, because it's an interesting conversation that a lot of companies go through. And for some people, the recommendation is, hey, maybe for the claims you want to make, de novo is the proper path. Granted, I understand it's more expensive and a longer submission time, but if you can't make those claims, do you have a product at the 510K level? Sometimes you do, right? And that's why you go towards the 510K, but sometimes you could almost hurt yourself by not going after that de novo. So I'd be interested to see if you had those internal discussions, what it was like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's the classic 510K route, and then there's de novo, and then there's a third area where it still results in a 510K, but is the breakthrough device designation. And so we absolutely had the discussion of de novo, and just for clarifying purposes, the reason we are not pursuing de novo right now is this is actually a very strategic decision led by our regulatory expert, Adam, actually. He has been very diligent, and it's kind of a way to think about AR, is that AR is a new visualization medium, but the claims that we're trying to make, actually there are predicates on the market today that do similar, very, very similar indications for use and applications and claims of what our first two 510K products will be capable of. And because of that, there's actually a, like you said, there's a cost difference, but there's also a technical system requirements and capability difference between the de novo route and the traditional 510K route, where there are some standards obviously that exist. If you're looking at a predicate, if you can show that your testing is similar or representative of, you have to show it for your predicate. There's a more straightforward path that way. And so kind of this whole idea about being on the bleeding edge of AR and AI in healthcare, we are taking the minimally viable approach and then breaching that into using an existing predicate to show, hey, we're a new visualization medium that can accomplish the same or similar claims of our predicate. And it's why we've chosen to go down that route rather than de novo. But one of the things we are absolutely considering is breakthrough. Some people talk about breakthrough device designations, kind of like this, middle ground that straddles the de novo benefits, but is obviously leads to the traditional 510K route. So that's something we're absolutely considering, is that breakthrough device designation, because of what it does to your basically your place in line. And especially with COVID, the FDA is backed up quite a bit with various submissions and regulatory dockets. So it is very much within our strategic plan right now to potentially pursue the breakthrough device designation, which would give us some of the benefits similar to what happens on the de novo side, but really keeps us focused on the traditional 510K route that we're pursuing right now, given that there are predicates that do similar things that our first two products will basically build upon, and we believe will produce a more intuitive user interface and experience, which we hope through clinical data and IRB data to show result in non-inferiority to these current products that are on the market today.
That's wonderful. So that's super helpful. The thought process there for companies who are in the same boat, which is a lot of companies. I mean, like everyone, I think everyone knows that, right? I mean, most medical devices that are, and I forget the delineation between the three, but clear, approved, and whatever the third one is, right? The proper names for PMA and 510K and de novo, most of them are 510K products. I mean, that's most products that go through the FDA in a year. So most companies and most startups are sitting here kind of going back and forth on that. And I think that you providing some insight there is helpful. So the other thing I had written down was you talked about HR coming internally, and that's another big that we've actually talked about this over coffee, culture of the company, right? And it's something that we feel so strongly about at Project MedTech that is important, that is often overlooked, is the culture you're building at the company. One of my partners, Aaron Tenuheisen, is an absolute stickler at our company for culture. Now there's just three of us here at Project MedTech. But he is so adamant that this is something we focus on right now so that it becomes a habit as we go forward. But we feel so adamantly about, we've had two or three guests on who have really no med device experience to talk about how you build culture as a company and how you continue to scale that. So just curious, you said you brought HR in. Maybe talk a little bit about the culture that you've built at MedAview too, because I know we've talked about it and I generally remember some of the pieces of it, but you said it was amazing, right? And that's something as a startup company, you know, you have to build, you have to attract people to your company, right? I mean, the fact of the matter is Medtronic, Boston Scientific, J&J, any of the behemoths, they can offer phenomenal packages for people to join, right? So as a startup company, you counter that by saying, hey, we're going to be as competitive as we can in some areas. We realize we can't offer, you can only offer so much, but how do you make it a culture where, you know, Dwayne Mancini says, hey, I know I might be able to go get more money from one of the biggest companies. However, the culture I'm working in is much more conducive to my lifestyle and maybe my overall happiness. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm really excited that you brought that up, Dwayne, because culture is one word that actually means a lot. So there's over, you know, and actually since we met back in January, we're at MedAview, we're really intentional about the culture that we're building. And there's three T's that really drive our culture and define it. And because while culture can be considered a noun or an adjective, how do you actually create it and actually make people feel like it's part of the day-to-day, you know, lifeblood and integration of the company day-to-day? And the T's that we really build are the following three. It's trust, team, and track record. And those three T's, there's actually a fourth, which is technical capability in each respective domain of the company, but that's almost a pay to play. If you don't have the technical capabilities or skills to fulfill a job duty, it's probably not the right fit anyway. So the other three T's, even if they're perfect, it's not the right fit. So when we stick to the trust, team, and track record, That's played out every day, right? So and those are listed in priority order. And people say, well, the word trust is so soft, but it's actually not. And if you are familiar, and if you're not, it's an excellent book. It's called The Speed of Trust by Stephen Covey, and it changed the way we think, at least I can say personally, about what trust means. And Duane, if you ask somebody, what is the most common phrase people associate the word trust with, they say, oh, you've earned my trust or you've lost my trust. But trust, if you can think about it in a different way of extending it freely, opens up doors of opportunity and reduces the inertia of becoming an integrated team much, much faster. Now, you extend trust freely, it doesn't have to be earned, but when you extend it freely, you are inherently opening yourself up to be burned, rather than have. So it takes a longer time to earn trust, but if you extend trust freely, and yeah, you might get burned. But Stephen Covey talks about in a really interesting way. High trust equals low cost, fast speed. Low trust equals, and this is, he's proven this out in a variety of industries actually. Low trust results in high project costs and slower speeds of development for whatever industry you're working in. His approach to describing it has been amazing. So that really is the foundation at MediView, is that, we walk into every meeting, whether it's on the commercialization side, whether it's on the development side, whether it's on the organizational side, and there's a foundation and underlying essence of trust. Meaning you can come in and everyone, I rarely will use the word should in any discussion. Everyone should say what is on their mind and what they want to make sure is considered within any capacity, whether it's a engineering problem, how we're building out our sales force, or how we're creating our organizational structure. So that's the first T in how we're building that culture. The second is team. And that's a really important part. Right before our call, we were doing an interview for a position. And you think about it, is that the book Blitzscaling, really interesting book, talks about that as a startup, there's really phases, right? And there's, there's the family nucleus phase, then there's the city, then there's the state, then there's the nation, then there's the world. So, and they actually talk about the number of people associated with each of these phases. So we're now on that threshold of, we're still in that nucleus phase, but we're about to branch out to that city phase. So every person that we bring in, the book talks about how the leadership team is responsible, just as a parent is, to make sure that every new family member that enters a family has a good fit. That every new person that joins a company, you're fundamentally responsible for how that person interacts with the team members that exist, but now you're also responsible for that individual and their day-to-day happiness, their day-to-day satisfaction, their day-to-day fulfillment in a job role. So creating that environment of a team is critical to us. That then leads into the track record, both at an individual level coming in to the company, is what does your track record look like coming into the company? And that obviously helps establish if it's a good fit for the team and why you can trust somebody, why you can extend it freely. But now we start building a track record for MediView as an entity. So you have individual track records coming in to build that team that can lead to that free extension of trust. But then once that it's all established, we've got to deliver now as MediView to establish that, hey, as a company and as a team, we have our own respective track record. And a lot of literature out there, peer-reviewed literature, psychology, and a lot of different variety of books talk about that one of the greatest builders of culture is track record, success, and clarity of direction. And that's really what we're trying to piece together between, taking that, pay to play technical capability in each of the various pillars and verticals, and then is, extending that trust freely within a team that you're excited to work with, that establishes a track record of success. And if it's not success, the opportunity to learn from failure, in my opinion, is just as important as a track record of success, is how do you respond to challenges and failure, especially in a startup space? Because if you don't, well, you might as well kiss the company goodbye. So that's That's how we think about culture.
Okay, I love it. And this really kind of flows in nicely to, you know, I wanted to have you on, not to just talk about MetaView and where you guys are, but also things you've learned along the way and advice you would have for startups. So those were the two major things I had asked, and you had kind of given me a list a little bit of some of the different things. So I want to start with what you have learned, because one of those was trust, team, and track record. And we just talked about that, right? And then there was a handful of others, and you just started talking about failing, right? And one of the ones you had written down was fail forward, fail fast, fail often. So maybe talk a little bit more about that. You know, failing forward, right? It sounds like a double negative almost, but you know, maybe talk about what you mean there.
So one member of our team embodies this probably the best, because during our sprint reviews every week, when we're reviewing the progress, high functioning contributor to the team, very, very skilled in Unity and mixed reality development. But he celebrates failure and saying, "I have successfully failed." And what he usually means by that is you set out a goal, we set lofty and aggressive goals for our development sprints at a micro level that eventually up to the entire project. Now, you know, the cost of failure, if you can encourage it, is much cheaper at the micro level early on. And the cost of failure grows as a project and product development activity gets later onto the different phase gates of development that eventually lead to your verification and validation. And what we mean by that is, when Ivan, who's the engineer on our team, talks about this as "I've successfully failed," it means we set out a definition of what we were trying to accomplish during this finite amount of time, and we only accomplished 30% of it. Well, we just learned 30% of something that we knew zero about 2 weeks ago. And that's successful failure. And people, like you said, they're like, "That's a juxtaposition. That doesn't make, what do you mean successful failure?" Well, over time, if you continue to build up the buckets of successful failure, eventually you will just reach success without the failure. And being comfortable with that and saying, this is a culture and spirit of experimentation and development and team level development where you can work together, is something that's really important. I mean, just to kind of give you a little bit of insight, Dwayne, we just held Innovation Week at MediView, and you know, we actually paused all product development and commercial development activities and responsibilities for a period of time. And the team got to experiment with things well outside of the scope of any products that we're delivering right now. And what we saw is people set these really lofty goals to accomplish things, and people accomplish things that, I've been in this industry for this technology space for 5.5 years, that I never even thought about. And they did it in a very finite amount of time.
Wow.
Some of them didn't fulfill what they hoped for, but they were able to show some really amazing progress. And I think that when we talk about successful failure, as an engineer in an engineering team, there's always a pursuit of perfection, but you have to be comfortable with what's good enough. And because there's all of this underlying capability and technology in the products in that build the value proposition for the end user. But I think we also have to remember that there's probably a subset of capabilities that the end user could find value in today. So if you're pursuing this, but you successfully fail and only accomplish this, this amount of success actually could be a viable commercial product in the field. So it's not just an experimental successful failure, but successful failure might actually result in a product embodiment that you never even thought about that can deliver value to an end user today instead of 3 years from now. So if I were to summarize it, we really talk about this setting lofty but realistic goals, being okay with not fulfilling all of the acceptance criteria within a finite amount of time, and then seeing, okay, how much more incrementally do we need to successfully iterate to accomplish a threshold of acceptance? And is it needed to deploy a product? Or do we need to wait a little bit longer and refine a little bit more in order to be able to get to that commercial viability stage? So that's how we think about successful failure.
I love it. Okay, awesome. The other one you had written, oh, there's a few more, but what does it mean to be a big little startup?
So the big little startup is a passion of mine and something I'm continuing to evolve on a personal level, but it's built out of a professional perspective, is that you talked about the world, there's the behemoths in the world, and they've obviously done a lot of things right and scaled in ways to establish themselves as the world leaders in med tech. And as a startup, yeah, you don't have, you know, we're not an IPO. We don't have an endless flow of money coming in. And we have to be very judicious about where we put our money. But there are things, and I'm going to continue to come back to this HR perspective, right? Where early on, Dwayne, and as a startup, you need to be able to do this. I was doing all recruiting. I was on LinkedIn, trying to go on LinkedIn, trying to find people, working. Eventually I got to the point where, like, listen, I can't do the role of progressing our product development plus recruiting. So you make choices as a little startup of how to act big. And it's, we really think of it as a force multiplier. So it's not that we are, you know, building out, you know, individual functions for every little part of the company. But if there's a function that we perceive to be a force multiplier that allows the people who are contributing at a product development and a commercialization level to be much more effective and to offload some of their business administration tasks or other functional responsibilities and bring a person to take those on, we will do that. Now, we have to be very judicious about it. So when we talk about the big little startup, it's, we're little, right? We're growing. We're not quite big, but if we can think big and think big in regards to our goals, our vision at MediView being around merging the physical and digital worlds to advance healthcare with visualization, communication, and insights. To deliver on that is why we come to work every day. And any way that we can make each person on an individual basis as efficient and productive as possible, while building out the team around them to support them in the areas they need to open up bandwidth on, we put very serious thought about how to do that. Another really interesting area is regulatory, where at first we were outsourcing regulatory. We had a great regulatory partner, but it got to a point where, because of the technology being so new and the user interface being so novel and being able to engage at a deep level with the FDA through some of the mediums that we've talked about, we decided that it was the right thing as the company grew to bring in the regulatory expertise internal to MediView that works day in and day out with our engineers. And now, as we're making that crossover from development to commercialization, having that regulatory person that comes on and says, hey, you can't call it a cleared medical device because it's just it's a registered medical device, or saying, hey, here's how we should look at the evaluation of claims to decide between de novo versus the traditional 510K route. There's just an efficiency to be gained there. And of course, we're extremely thankful to our fund, you know, our investors who've allowed us to make those type of decisions. And the last area really is, you know, it's funny to say this as a startup, even with the technologies that are novel as ours, but we still think every single day of how does MediView disrupt itself? And the people that you're like, you guys are barely to commercial yet. So how can you talk about disrupting yourselves? But there are capabilities, right, that we know are coming down the pipeline from a competitive landscape perspective that we're already thinking about. So when we go out to raise money, we form and phrase our strategic roadmap. We paint the holy grail picture, the euphoric vision of where we want to be, describe how we're starting with our minimally viable product, but then we are investing in at a reasonable level, not at a full product development level, but investing in some of the core pillars that are going to be needed to be successful in order to recognize that euphoric holy grail state And not just to be a pipe dream, but that it's actually building on a platform at a minimally viable level and then scales from there. So in summary, building the infrastructure and components, even at a small startup that allows individuals to be successful, investing in the future of MediView today, even as we're moving into the commercial state of looking to disrupt ourselves and to leverage commercialization and product development best practices from the recognized world leaders, Medtronic, J&J, Abbott, Boston Scientific, et cetera, is really how we think about being that big little startup.
Okay, I like that. We kind of talked about engage regulators, you know, along the path. I also assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that what you mean by this is that, and this is something that I try to talk to startups about all the time, is pre-submission meetings, open discussion with them, and this is specific to the FDA, right? On where your products might fall and what you're trying to do and familiarizing them with your device. The question I get a lot is, well, we're not ready for a pre-submission meeting yet. And my pushback to them is always, are you sure? You know, even if you have concepts or an idea, it might not be a bad idea to get in front of the FDA, get in front of your who's going to be your reviewer, discuss with them what you're trying to do, where you're going. And there's more strategy behind, you know, going to that pre-submission meeting. I always recommend going with a regulatory expert. But is that kind of what you mean there by engaging regulators along the path?
So I'm really happy you asked, Wayne, because there's actually another opportunity with the FDA that's even before a pre-sub, or doesn't have to be a pre-sub, and it's an informational session with the FDA.
Right.
It doesn't require a pre-sub, because a pre-sub would say you have to have at least the foundation of your design controls with respect to a QMS in place to show what does your requirements look like, what does your risk management look like, what do your verification validation test method and, you know, master validation plan look like. And so they can give you tangible feedback during a pre-sub meeting, which is great, right? But there's a step before that, that which is called an informational session with the FDA to present to them your concept and your capabilities. I've been, you know, blessed and lucky enough to participate in a number of these over the years. This is not just startups that do this. We're talking about the top three companies in the world, right? MedTech in the world that still do this. And that's something that I think a lot of startups, you may not be ready for a pre-sub meeting, but you're always ready for an informational meeting if you got something to show them. And it's a pathway, right? So it's a progression where if you start at the informational meeting, the regulators at the FDA, they're awesome people. They're really excited. They want good and value-added products to come to market, to expand access to healthcare and raise the quality of healthcare being delivered and reduce costs over time. But at the end of the day, they have to make sure it's safe and efficacious. Mm-hmm. But if you bring them, right, I mean, we always ask ourselves, hey, do you want your grandma getting a treatment with this device? And if you can't answer yes, you're probably not doing the right things day to day. Like, so, you know, one of the things is like, start with an informational meeting. You're always excited. Now, COVID has slowed it down during the past year, but it's starting to pick up again, their openness to these informational meetings. And you start engaging them. You start learning which regulator you're going to be working with in your specific domain or space. And that person very well may be assigned for your pre-sub meeting and very well may be assigned as your docket reviewer for your actual submission. So there's this pathway that if you started early on, you know, I said this in a previous comment, the cost of engagement is a lot cheaper early on rather than waiting all the way till the end. And a lot of the times, if the first time the regulators see your product, company, or concept at a docket submission perspective, it is held to a slightly higher standard and a lot more scrutiny. So engaging them as stakeholders early on has tremendous benefits as you get further and further to commercialization.
Yeah. Hey, it's like anything, you got to build a relationship, right? Absolutely. I mean, we'll just take a very simplistic example, but if I walked up to my wife 11 years ago when I met her and just said, will you marry me? She would have said no. But 6 years or 7 years of dating, and she first, you know, some reason said yes, right? So, you know, it's the same thing. It's the same thing with FDA regulators. You got to build a relationship. Awesome. So, in the interest of time, you know, you had engage end users and product definition. I think that's fairly self-explanatory. And I think that if listeners are really interested in this section, we did a whole like 50-minute podcast on this with Devin Campbell from Product about taking in voice of customer through the entire process. I encourage people to go listen to that episode. It's episode 47. I want to move on. I'm assuming, you know, just we have some advice for startups, and some of them are fantastic. So I want to get to those. The other piece that you learned along the way was do things that do not scale to gain first mover and first scaler advantage. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah, I mean, there's sometimes speed is of the essence, right? And sometimes when it's a competitive space, a lot of people I think are familiar with the concept of more familiar with the concept of first mover, but then there's this concept of first scaler. And you can be a first mover, but not be a first scaler. And this has proven out in the tech space quite a bit, actually. The classic example is Nokia and BlackBerry in the smartphone space, where they were first movers, but they were not first scalers. And iPhone truly was the first scaler. And we've seen what's happened in, well, at least in the US, obviously biggest market.
Sure. Yep.
But it's this concept that sometimes you do things early on that are not sustainable into the scale as the company grows. And let me give an example of that. So early on, we will support our clinical cases, you know, day to day with our clinicians. Is it feasible that we're going to have a MediView representative down the line when we're doing, hundreds of cases a day? No. But today, to put a MediView representative in every case to learn and to understand where the product needs to improve and where it needs to advance to be more and more useful, that helps you figure out how to scale the capabilities, how to scale the features, and to get you to that first scaler perspective. And yeah, sometimes it requires capital and it requires people resources, which obviously we're a mixed reality and AI company, which hopes to remove some burden of human resources day to day. But early on, you do things that establish a presence for you, that establish a scaling for you, that doesn't necessarily make sense 2, 3, 4 years down the line. But it gives you that acceleration to help establish a market presence and start scaling the organization. Mm-hmm. That's the fundamental message is, you know, what is going to help you establish yourself in the market as a leader, not just a first mover, but truly as a leader that has a scalable solution, even if it doesn't make sense, 5 years down the line.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. I love it. Advice for startup companies in the med tech space, right? So, you've obviously worked at some of the largest medical device companies in product development, and a lot of that advice probably translates directly into startups. And you're also at a successful startup company, so I wanted to ask you this ahead of time as well, and see your thoughts. And the first thing you wrote down was respect the industry.
So medtech, like other regulatory industries, is not consumer, and we are held to standards that are a higher threshold of showing that your product is safe and efficacious to be used within the indications for use and scope of use that you're using. And there is a growing competitive environment, but that doesn't justify putting a product out there that may just pass verification and validation, but hasn't actually gone through the rigor of like, what do my use conditions look like? Because you can test something on the bench all day long and see performance, But when you release this thing into the wild, how is it going to perform under various conditions? And have you accounted for those conditions? Now, you can't account for everything. And I'll go back to my statement earlier is, you know, perfection is the enemy of good enough. And there is a good enough threshold, but then there's a not good enough threshold as well. So being able to sit back and say, you know, would I trust a family member to be treated or diagnosed with my product? You got to be able to ask yourself that. What if I'm a patient of a product that we're developing? So respecting the industry in the sense that these are people's lives that we are building solutions for. And the technology can be developed at a rate much faster than it can be adopted. So it goes to one of my, I think I mentioned, I was looking at the list around market pull versus technology push.
Yeah. And
it's a critical part is that just like we talked about regulators, is bring the end user stakeholders along for the ride. In that, in our space, you know, less than 1% of the world's population has ever put on a HoloLens or an AR device. So now you're asking to ask a clinician to put a headset on that they've never used before while delivering care to a patient. You better find a way to bring them along for that ride and reduce that learning curve, because you want them to adopt it for obviously business viability, but even more so that, you know, the industry around mixed reality and AI doesn't suffer. There's a lot of examples, actually. A really good one is hypertension. So back in 2007, 2008, big companies were trying to do something called renal denervation, where they were performing a stimulation of the renal anatomy to help literally eradicate hypertension from patients, actually cure it, rather than having to be on drugs forever. And the technology was developing, but one of the clinical studies came back and actually showed that it was not performing how they expected. And what happened was, is the technology wasn't ready for a clinical study, and it took the entire industry down with it. And only after 13 years has renal denervation actually restarted again to be a viable solution to treat hypertension. So you have to respect the industry and be sure that you're releasing products when they're ready to be considered safe and efficacious across a wide range of use conditions and environments.
Awesome. You know, one thing is the second time you mentioned about treating a family member. This is a conversation that I don't have often, which makes me happy. But you know, sometimes I would get customers who have, you know, class three medical devices who need to run a first in human study. And, you know, they would say, I don't think we're going to have it here in the US. It's easier if I go do it in, you know, a South American country, for example. And I would always say, okay, are you doing this for specific reasons other than the fact that you don't want to have to prove it's safe? Because the reasons you just gave make it sound like it's the latter, right? And that makes you concerned. You know, and I know we would turn down working with those types of companies because we didn't feel as if they had the correct reasoning for why they were doing it, right? In some cases, it 100% makes sense. Definitely. But, you know, when you're saying, well, we don't want to do all the biocompatibility in this product, well, that's probably an issue, right? So it's not exactly something that sounds great. And I'd always just spin it on them of saying, you know, would you let this product go into your mom, your dad, your brother, your sister, your aunt, your uncle? And if the answer is no, then you should probably rethink it. So I'm glad you brought that up, because it's something that I've brought up in just a few episodes in the past, but not as consistent as we probably should. So thank you for bringing that up.
And you know, Duane, it's really interesting. I never thought this, and I've only brought this up, I think, in a couple of conversations. I have a family friend who actually received a heart valve that I helped work on. And I never, and you know, to realize that was, I'm like, oh my God, I'm happy we did the diligence on the development of this thing.
Right.
Then my aunt, who has atrial fibrillation, actually received an ablation with a cryoballoon ablation that I helped work on. And two instances, now, you know, I try to stay in relatively decent health and shape, so hopefully I don't become a customer. But you never know, really. I mean,
Yeah.
it's, you really never know what could happen. As amazing and as strong as the human body is, life is also fragile. And you know, I think how you approach your day-to-day activities of prioritizing others in front of yourself creates a way of working in the med tech space that prioritizes significance over success. And that significance really means, what have I contributed in a positive way to the world today? And you know, that's very different than what people traditionally think of the definition of success. They're not mutually exclusive, but one carries, at least from the way, my viewpoint of the world, right, a different weight day to day. So I think those are things that we always have to think about, especially in regulated industries such as medtech.
I agree. I agree. The other two, just in the interest of time that I'm looking at for your advice, the two that I really wanted to bring up and kind of drive home is one with proactive fundraising, but let's save that for the end. Educate partners along the way to help break down barriers to adoption. Okay, so this is something we just covered. We just covered this in an episode with Devin Campbell again, because this was a three-part series. So I keep bringing him up, but it's just
Sure.
recent, it's in my head. But the other one was, I just posted this on LinkedIn a week ago at the time we're recording this. So obviously this isn't going to be released next week. But I just posted about an interview I had with Dr. Amy Baxter of Pain Care Labs, and her the video snippet I took from there was about, when you get approval, you are going to have to travel through what I call the Valley of Death, which is, hey, I have approval, or I have FDA, this is, I can actually sell this product now, to you've actually successfully commercialized this and made it and sold it and are on the market. You've captured regional market. You're doing well. Everyone has to go through it. It's just whether you make it out the other side or not. And there's this issue that Amy had brought up, or Dr. Baxter, sorry, that was there, the rate of adoption of a new technology is more difficult than you think. And she provided reasons why from a clinician standpoint, and really focused on the training. We had someone comment on there about another issue as well, and it started a nice little conversation, but there's a lot of reasons why. How do you combat that, right? And so you're proposing educating partners along the way so that you have a quicker adoption. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's you know, for quicker adoption in the whether it's a customer and end user purchasing your system. When we went to go do our 60601 testing, literally went on site with them. This is the first time they had seen a mixed reality and system come to their facility, and there's no required quote unquote training for your testers. But I knew if we if a couple headsets and some medical equipment showed up at the test house, these people really know what to do. And do we really want them to have to feel like they're going through this steep learning curve just to test our system? Because like you said, Dwayne, it's all about relationship building and establishing that sense of trust between people. And well, that's all the way from the testing perspective with the testing houses, all the way to the end user and the customer. And this is probably a whole separate discussion that we can get into sometime around Amy's right, that there are different factors with new technology that impact adoption. Now, there are also, if you're familiar with the book The Innovator's Solution by Clay Christensen, who talks about there are ways though for the for encouraging adoption of new technology by positioning it from the perspective of, I'm actually helping you do your job better and more efficiently. And when you connect with them, not at a technology level, but on a jobs to be done on an interpersonal level, and show how the product adds a value to their day-to-day life and you meet them where they are, right? It's not that we're pushing this new technology. It's that we're providing a solution to address. It doesn't even have to be a clinical unmet need. It could truly be the way the job is being done today is an unmet need, right? Of how do you make doctors are parents, right? Doctors are spouses. How do you give, you know, these clinicians an extra 30 to 45 minutes back every day so they can get home an hour earlier to be with their kids before they go to sleep? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you create value that we consider intangible sometimes, but is very tangible for the end user? So when you're bringing them along for that ride, so they don't have to struggle through adoption and go through that valley of death that you are talking about, the likelihood, right, of coming out the other side is exponentially higher.
That's great. That's great advice. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, right? Is, and I think you bring up a good point, and Devin had brought up a good point, right? He had run from the rim of the Grand Canyon down and back up the other side, right? And like he said, I don't get to the edge of the rim and go, okay, let me start preparing for this, right? You prepare for it the entire time. And it starts in product development. So I think preparing for that launch of commercialization, like you just said, it starts throughout the whole process so that when you get to the time of, hey, you know, the rubber meets the road here, you're well equipped for it, right?
Absolutely.
Understanding that how you think you're going to go through the valley of death is probably different than how you actually go through, but being prepared for all the possible things that can go wrong and have those inputs in place is important. So great point.
I just wanted to touch on something there, is that it's actually something we're very intentional about at MediView. So, you know, we scale the number of formative usability testing, but we do something very intentional, is that we record we do very meaningful formative usability testing, but we record every session, of course, at the permission of the user. But what we end up doing is we take that feedback and we actually tie the feedback in text to a product improvement. So the next time the user sees it, says, here's the things that you said would make this a more usable or valuable component or feature. And we said, we make it very explicit. We tie together the feedback directly to what it used to look like compared to what it does look like. And we help them, we make it very explicit so they don't have to remember, hey, what was my actual feedback to MediView? And did they actually take it into consideration? We're very forthcoming, saying, this is the feedback you gave us. Here's where the product did not satisfy what you were looking for. And here's what we've come up with. Does it fill the delta? So, you know, making it as simplistic as possible to communicate that, I think, is a critical part of how you go through the product development cycle.
Okay, great advice. Okay. The last one, proactively fundraise. Put yourself in a position where you don't need money, right? And you kind of put, you know, people want to give money to startups that don't need it, and VCs don't want to miss out, right? So maybe talk a little bit about this, because this really falls in with Anthony Caparso. He was an early episode. He's a Cleveland guy. He's part of what was Inhale Medical, which is now 12 Medical. And one of the points he brought up was raising smart money, right? So this kind of fills in nicely. It also fills in nicely with our mini series here at Project MedTech, or not mini series, but separate series called MedTech Money with Giovanni. But maybe discuss a little bit about that, the fundraise perspective. And, you know, we're going to have more detail on it in other episodes, but it's always good to get people's perspective here because it is such a big part of being a successful med tech company. So I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, the perspective that we've taken and it's worked for us to date, you know, so far, is that going back to the TF track record, is that we want to establish a track record of using funds in a proactive and successful way, and that we're not, you know, burning through funds at a rate that puts our pipeline in jeopardy, right? The way we've laid out our product development strategy and the three products that we're going to bring to market will help us realize the full capability of what AR in healthcare can do. And for us, the fundraising side is we don't want to wait till we need the money to deliver the third leg of our product platform portfolio, but show that, hey, listen, we said we're going to do this with this subset of money and delivering these first two product iterations, and we still have plenty of runway, but we are already thinking about and have already gotten commercial feedback on what features would help this solution scale beyond what it is today. And we have a first mover insight about these new technologies that's valuable to you as an investor. So not only are you investing in a new solution that we've garnered interest and actual commercial support for, we're actually giving you this opportunity to look into the future based on real-world data of where this product portfolio and this technology capability is going. So help us build that future before we're, you know, before it becomes an immediate priority for us. And again, you heard me talk about this earlier when I was talking about the big little startup. That's what I meant when I was talking about we're already investing in aspects of technology capability and commercialization infrastructure today that will truly become useful in 2 to 3 years from now. And being able to show our investors what that pipeline looks like, it requires strategic vision to be able to communicate an effective and cohesive message so they can say, you're at point C, how are you going to get to point, you know, Z down the road? And that's what we're trying to do right now is not just focus on what do we need to get to our, you know, initial 510K clearances, but what does the product iteration look beyond MVP? And that creates a lot of excitement we've learned with potential investors that are interested in this space, that believe in this space, and that can see how we're going to go from current state of technology to future state of technology, and they want to be along the ride for that.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Well, listen, Mina, I really appreciate your time. This has been a action-packed episode. There's a ton to learn. I find that when companies are in the process of, you know, growing and going through what it takes to be a successful startup company, the advice and the things learned are just so recent that it's so helpful for other companies going through the same thing, right? So I really appreciate your time today. In closing, do you have anything else to add?
No, really, Duane.
Okay.
Thank you, Ray, for having me on, and I appreciate the opportunity. I know many of you appreciates the opportunity,
Yeah.
and if I can be a resource for anyone, and I'm happy to always talk and connect with anyone. And I'll even do the opposite is if someone believes they can be a resource for MediView, right? Or someone hears something on this podcast that they don't agree with and they want to give me a new perspective to learn from, I'm always open to those opportunities as well. So really,
Yeah.
again, Wayne, really appreciate the opportunity to be on with you today. It's truly a blessing and honor. Thank you.
Awesome. And happy to have you. And in the show notes, I'll include a hyperlink to to MediView's website, your LinkedIn profile. And for anyone listening, maybe you're in the car or you can't click on the link. If you search Mina Fahim, MINA space Fahim, FAHIM, you can find him on LinkedIn and connect with him as well. But no, I really appreciate your time. Hang on for 1 second. We'll do a quick download after this, but thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Dwayne.
Yep.
Awesome. You're doing Project Mentor.
Awesome. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.